Shrink Wrap Radio number 334, The Fear Project with Jamal Yogis.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is journalist Jamal Yogis, an adventure-loving journalist, and we'll be discussing his new book, The Fear Project, in which he recounts stories dealing with confronting his own fears and what he's learned about fear from interviewing numerous neuroscientists. Jamal Yogis is an author, journalist, and outdoorsman. His first book, a coming-of-age memoir called Saltwater Buddha, was praised by the Times of London, The Age, Publishers Weekly, the San Francisco Chronicle, and is currently being made into a film. Jamal's second book, The Fear Project, is a personal and journalistic investigation into our most primal emotion. To report the story, Jamal plunged into the water with great white sharks, surfed waves as tall as four-story buildings, visited some of the world's most cutting-edge neuroscience labs, and interviewed some of the top extreme athletes and psychologists. A graduate of Columbia Journalism School, Jamal's magazine reporting has won awards such as the 2005 Leslie Rachel Sanders Award for Social Justice Reporting, a 2007 Maggie Award for Best Magazine Feature, and two Scripps Howard Reporting Scholarships. In 2010, the Commonwealth Club voted him the new face of San Francisco media for his popular writing in San Francisco Magazine, thebolditalic.com, and the San Francisco Chronicle. His stories have also been published in ESPN Magazine, Afar, Runner's World, The Surfer's Journal, The Washington Post, The Chicago Tribune, and many others. He's been a guest lecturer at UC Berkeley, Columbia University, and San Francisco State. Jamal lives in San Francisco with his wife, Amy, and his son, Kai. Now, here's the interview. Jamal Yogis, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. I love your book. I feel like I should prostrate myself on the ground. I'm not worthy. I have to tell you, you're one of my new heroes. I love your book, and I feel like I know you through it. And it really made me question interviewing you on Skype as opposed to our getting together in person, because I know you live in San Francisco and I'm up in Sonoma County, not so far away. And I thought, well, maybe we could meet midway in Marin County somewhere. But I'm actually able to make a better recording using Skype because I can get our voices on separate tracks, which I can then edit if one of us is coughing or something like that. So so this will have to do.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I am really honored to be on the show because I'm a huge fan as well. And as I was saying to you just before the show, I don't think I have the knowledge base of some of your acclaimed guests like Joseph Ledoux and Philippe Golden and some of these world-renowned psychologists and neuroscientists, but I'll do my best.
Yeah, well, I'm not worried about that at all, because in your book, you really showed that you are an attentive student at the very least. Now, your book is titled The Fear Project, which is perfect for what you set out to do. So maybe you can share with our listeners what that vision for The Fear Project was.
Sure. I mean, The Fear Project stemmed out of a personal need to understand fear. You know, I think fear plays a huge role in all of our lives, but sometimes we don't notice how much it's playing a role until a crisis hits.
Yeah.
And for me, that crisis was just something that sounds pretty ordinary, a breakup with my girlfriend. But as a lot of people have experienced with breakups, it can feel like the end of the world. It can feel like the death of a loved one, because for all intents and purposes, this person who you've loved more than anyone is now out of your life. And
Oh yeah, I'm remembering a time when I actually felt fairly suicidal due to a breakup. So it's definitely
exactly. Yeah. And I mean, when you read the statistics on divorce and the health impacts that a divorce has on most people, you realize, wow, this is one of the most stressful things that the human psyche can endure.
Yes.
Is losing a loved one through a breakup or, you know, through a death, which I think is ultimately much worse, but it can feel that way. And so that's what sort of got me into that deep, dark hole. And I needed a way to clamber out. And my parents are big into Buddhism, and so I'd grown up doing meditation, and that was a big part of my life, and still is. But when you are really in the darkness, so to speak, sometimes the things you've relied on in the past you no longer trust, especially mm-hmm. because relationship is so caught up with our romantic relationships are so intertwined with our relationship with our parents that this breakup had made me want to throw everything from my past in the garbage and start at square one. I felt like I needed new tools, and that's when I started interviewing neuroscientists and psychologists. I felt as a journalist I had this free ticket where I could call these people up and say, hey, I'm writing an article or I'm writing a book. Can I interview you? And I could read their books, and I just needed a fresh take. And so I decided to come at it through this neuroscience psychology angle, mostly out of necessity. It seemed like that was the field that had the most sort of concrete answers. Like, if you do this, we know that this can happen, and yeah. We've seen it on other people. It wasn't nebulous. It didn't have any airy fairiness. And I could say, okay, this guy did that or this woman did that and it worked and I'm going to try it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love the title, as I said, The Fear Project. And it seems like the perfect title because you made it such a project, and it has these dual aspects that you've integrated so well, with one aspect being your personal story, not only of the breakup that you start out with, but also athletic challenges, of scary athletic challenges of deep water swimming and major surfing. And then you interviewed all these major neuroscientists, and it sounds like, unlike me who's interviewing people over Skype and the phone, it sounds like you actually went in person to a number of them. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I did. Whenever possible, I got together face to face, and one of the key interviews that really set a foundation for the book was going to Daniela Schiller's office at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, where I actually got to be a guinea pig in her lab. And she's a protege of Joseph Ledoux, who I only got to interview over the phone because mm-hmm. he's so incredibly busy. But experiencing that her experiment in the lab was really transformational, and that I came back to that point again and again, that fear is an experience. And so to overcome fear, we need to have an experience, because just talking to ourselves can help, but to really reach those deeper layers of the primal brain where fear comes from, we need to have an experience. And that's where the athleticism came from, and where wanting to interview these people in person came from, and wanting to spend time with extreme athletes came from, was I wanted to absorb through osmosis as much as I could from these people and also have an experience. And I did get to have the honor of spending time with a lot of these people.
Yeah, and we get to go on the journey with you. And just reading the book, I felt like I had an experience. I just finished it last night, and I was so moved by the story that you tell around the birth of your first child, So I'm kind of skipping all over the place here. By the way, your book is so chock full of great stories from your personal adventures and from these neuroscientists that you visited. So feel free to sprinkle them liberally into our conversation.
Sure. Yeah, I'll talk about that one because I just got off talking about Daniela Schiller and that experiment. I'll talk about the actual experience and why I thought it was so foundational for the rollout of the rest of the book was Daniela is doing these experiments with conditioned fear responses where basically she took me down into a little basement room where there's no windows, and her intern works steadfastly doing this experiment on patients and collecting data. And basically what he did is hooked one of my hands up to a fear measurement device, which measured the sweat on my skin and could measure just the slightest fear response. So even anxiety stress that I wasn't even aware of, it would show,
I imagine that's the galvanic skin response.
Exactly.
kind of part of the heart of most lie detectors too.
Right, exactly. So I'm hooked up to one of those on one, and then on the other, a little buzzer or a shocker, kind of like Peter Venkman used in Ghostbusters. And you know, these are old tools for you know all about them. And basically, I would see Danielle asked me to find a pattern in the shapes that she was about to show me on the screen. And so a series of blue and yellow squares arose. And I noticed that often when the blue squares appeared, I got a shock, not always. And it turned out that after just one of those blue square shock pairings, I had developed a fear response to the blue square. And not just when the blue square appeared, but when I thought the blue square might be coming, I got an anxiety spike. And soon the fear response for just a blue square without a shock was getting more of a response than when I was actually getting the shock.
Wow.
Which was so telling, because oftentimes experiencing a thing that we're afraid of is so much better than thinking about what it might be like when we experience it.
Yeah.
And so that was powerful in and of itself. But what Schiller has done is taken what we know about conditioned fear responses a step further, and she's started trying to understand why sometimes people can overcome a fear permanently and why sometimes we relapse. And so what she's done is, once you're afraid of the blue square and you know that, you come back the next day into the lab and you get positive exposure therapy to the blue squares. So one group will come in and get repeated blue squares without a shock. So positive exposure, and you're basically telling your primal brain, this is safe. I left out one important detail, is that you get a reminder of the blue square first. And then within 6 hours of that reminder, so you get the stress response, within 6 hours you get the positives therapy. With the other group, you get the reminder and you wait longer than 6 hours to do the positive exposure therapy. And with the group that gets it within the 6 hour window, they will remain fear-free of the blue square. But with the group that waits longer than 6 hours, they relapse into fear the next day. And basically what Schiller was showing is that there is a window of time in which once you conjure up a fear memory, you have time to sort of reassociate it or reconsolidate it. But outside of that 6 hour window, it's already reconsolidated. And so, I mean, there's so many important aspects to this study. One, it's saying that our memories are solid entities, and they can, and every time that you fall back on one, or every time you conjure one up, you're actually bringing back up the original memory in or that real estate in your brain, so to speak, and that there are ways to do that that are more reliable than others. And so I just found this, like, I mean, this just blew the doors off my whole paradigm of the way memory works. And the basic message is that we can change our fear memories and thereby change our outlook and how we react to things. But it helped me so much to experience this and be able to see the data on the screen and see how I could heal a fear memory through positive exposure. And that became foundational for wanting to take all my fears and basically give them positive exposure therapy, because and it became clear that action is such a key component of that. As wonderful as talk therapy is, and as much as I have done it and will continue to do it, that basic exposure and basic action is so helpful, and it's so easy to avoid because it's difficult to find ways to do it in your daily life. But that first experiment really influenced the rest of the book and continues to today.
Yeah, and what you're referring to, actually, I've done several interviews with people on the topic of memory reconsolidation, and so this is part of that research. You say it kind of blew the doors off some of your conceptions. I think it's also blown the doors off of our understanding of how effective psychotherapy works. And so it's really, it's been a really breakthrough set of data, and it's fascinating the way that you've kind of embraced it and used it in your own life, because as you point out, we tend not to, because it's fearful. We don't want to go where there's fear. And in some of my own personal darker moments, I've had the strong intimation that fear lies at the bottom of my mental processes. I can't remember what provoked this or exactly when it was, but I remember just kind of laying in bed during the dark night of the soul, you know, awake and in a self-examining mode. And it, you know, and what I saw at the bottom was a lot of fear, which was scary to look at.
So, yeah. And
it seems like some of the neuroscience that you've just covered kind of supports that idea.
Well, what you're describing is exactly the feeling I had when I began the Fear Project, was lying in bed awake, unable to sleep, and thinking everything in my life is covered in fear right in this moment. Yeah. Maybe this is the origin of so many of my actions without me knowing. And I want to go back to that. I just want to, before we get off the exposure therapy topic, I just wanted to address one insight I've had after having our baby, my son Kai, who's 11 months old now, is that, you know, this exposure therapy stuff, we use it intuitively with our children. With Kai, he was afraid. We went on a trip this summer. We had him sleeping in his crib, basically, and it took a while to get him feeling comfortable and safe in his crib alone at about 5 months, but we'd done it. And then we went traveling in Europe over the summer, and we couldn't keep him in his crib, so he slept in the bed with us for 2 months. And then when we came back, we put him back in the crib, and he was so upset at even seeing his crib or the thought that we would leave him in there. I mean, he would revolt, and he could stand up now, so he would rattle at the bars and and just, you know, scream at the top of his lungs. And we just thought, there's no way. We tried various things, letting him cry, and none of it seemed to be working. And we just thought, well, maybe we're going to be sleeping in the bed with him. But we talked with one consultant who said, you know, in really extreme cases, what I've done is climb into the crib with the baby let him know that that this is a safe place, you're not abandoning him, and then gradually, you know, leave him for long, you know, play with him in the crib. And then, so I did that. I actually slept in the crib with Pi for
now. You're over 6 feet tall.
I know. I mean, this is terrible murder on my back, but I did it, and immediately his opinion changed. And then we played with toys with him in the crib. And then we were basically doing a systematic desensitization technique where we were exposing him to his lowest fear, which was being in the crib with Dad, and then to a slightly higher one. We did baby steps. And it struck me that with our children, we do this constantly, right? The dark isn't so bad. Let me show you how the dark isn't bad by going there with you. But as adults, I think this becomes, it's almost like we think we're too smart. We're operating so much out of that logical parts of our brain that we forget that our fear center basically operates the same way a baby's does, where it needs to feel safe. It needs to feel an experience to feel safe. And so I've really started thinking of myself like a baby, and that I need, just like Kai, to say, oh, I'm afraid of public speaking. I need to do it and make a small toast at a party, as that first baby step and gain confidence like that. Because I think it feels a bit babyish to do that as an adult, but it works. And so I did want to say that. But as far as fear being at the base of what we do and our actions, I do think fear is a very early primal emotion. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but my theory is that desire comes before fear, in the sense that if you're an early organism, you know, getting food and reproducing is above fear. You also have to learn how to avoid predators and avoid dangers. But if you don't have that basic desire to move forward, that attraction, I think fearing is almost obsolete, because you know you're not gonna survive long enough to be in a situation where you should fear. So I think fear is one of the basics, but I think attraction comes first. And that's been interesting for me, thinking in terms of my background in Buddhism, because the Buddha didn't talk as much about fear. The Buddhist tradition talks a lot about how desire is the root of our fears. And I noticed that a lot in my own life, that my the root of my fear is that I want to succeed, and so I fear failure. I want love in my life, and so I fear losing it. And so I don't think it's at the root, but it's a very basic emotion, and part, the other side of the coin when it comes to attraction and aversion.
Yeah, and one of the things that come out in your overview, you do a really good job of integrating all the neuroscience. And one of the things that is clear that about why fear is so powerful is that it's sort of on the fast track. it comes up from the bottommost areas of the brain and activates the amygdala, and which seems to be kind of the fear center, if you will, among others associated with it, but sort of totally bypassing or not having a chance to get to the prefrontal area of the brain, where we kind of judge and moderate things and, you know, kind of reason them out. But the fear just gets there right away.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's needed to be... the way a lot of the scientists explained it to me is that the brain developed like an onion, right? Which, like, the most basic stuff at the core, heartbeat and breathing and fear. And, because fear is so basic, it's there at the core. And then we develop these layers where, you know, we can, build rocket ships and stuff, the prefrontal areas you're referring to. And so, but those basic ones are sort of like the, they're the most animal and they're the fastest, and they get, they send their messages. Ledoux has done work on this, you know, down to the millisecond of how quickly the amygdala can get its responses out to the body versus, the cortical areas. And so that, yeah, we have this slow lumbering professor and we have the ultra fast, sort of ninja emotional center. And yet ninja is not really a good metaphor because it's more of a ultra fast caveman, and that, it's throwing out all sorts of good fear responses and all sorts of bad ones. So, going back to that blue square shocker analogy, it's becoming really afraid of the blue square when the blue square isn't doing anything. It's that darn buzzer that's shocking you that you should be becoming afraid of, right? And so it's our task, you know, as modern humans to try to figure out what is the good fear and what is the bad fear. And that's not easy to do because we're getting these ultra light fast fear responses that are making us feel funny, faster heartbeat, sweat, etc. And then the lumbering professor catches up and has to say, what is this feeling? Is this a legitimate threat or not? And it takes some expertise to be able to determine whether the threat is legitimate or not. And my determination through the course of the book was that understanding how our brains work and then how our individual stress responses work is the key to doing that. You can't apply a blanket statement and say, this is how to differentiate between sort of the paper tigers and the real tigers. You have to take each individual and say, okay, what are your set of experiences? What's your base level of anxiety? What are your triggers? And then figure out, you know, how to use fear to your benefit, and then how to toss the rest and say, this is garbage and I don't need this in my life.
Yeah, we seem to, as much as we have this fear-based thing that serves the need for survival, we also seem to be drawn to face our fears. I'm thinking of babies who like to be tossed in the air, or toddlers, you know, who like to be tossed in the air, or later ride roller coasters and so on. So that, as much as anything, we seem to also have some kind of inner sensibility that says, "Well, let's try facing some of this stuff."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm thinking in the psychoanalytic tradition, some personalities are described as counterphobic or engaging in counterphobic behavior. And psychoanalysis, at least in the past, tends to give that a negative cast. But it seems to me that it might be fairly common and somewhat adaptive. And in my earlier years, and this is probably one of the things that really attracted me to you with your adventuresome soul, in my own earlier years, I was prone to doing lots of dangerous things, such as riding motorcycles and hopping freight trains and skydiving and becoming a glider pilot, not to mention tempting fate in various amorous adventures, which we will not go into here. And there was lots of fear underlying these adventures. But at the root, it seemed to me to be important to do these things, that they were somehow part of my self-initiation into manhood, if you will.
Yeah, you may make a lot of great points there. And I would just add that I do think that courage has been more adaptive for the humans, at least more modern humans than fear has. And it's what has allowed us to survive and become the alpha species of the planet. I mean, we wouldn't have spread into so many new areas of the earth if courage had not been driving us to, or exploration might be a better word. What's over that hill? Who who's going to be the one to go look for the new source of food because we're running low? Who's going to be the one to venture into the neighboring tribe to have an affair and diversify the gene pool? We're a risk-taking species, and that's the work of Marvin Zuckerman, who I put in the book as well. I didn't get to interview him, but I've read a lot of his stuff on high sensation-seeking personalities, and he often casts them in a sort of negative light too, because high sensation-seeking personalities are often the people who get involved in crime and take unnecessary risks and such. But I frankly think that is because we have tried to place these parameters on an adaptive piece of our makeup, which is exploration and courage and risk taking. And we live in a fairly risk averse world now, where we're told, you know, we should sit at our desk 8 hours a day, and sit at our in school, we're rewarded for staying put and following rules. And yet, for the last, 2 million years, it's been the opposite to a large degree, where those people who were willing to go out and venture over the mountain were rewarded, and often were the heroes. And, you know, other times they were the people who died early, and that's why some of the high anxiety traits also, I think, exist in the gene pool. Sometimes that was the adaptive trait. But they're both very important, and I think we're at a point in history where we're rewarding, to some extent, that ability to stay put and follow rules rather than to explore and take risks. And, you know, some of that's changing now with the entrepreneurship that's going on in you know, Silicon Valley and
such.
Interesting
point. That's
where
that's
it's all about risk and failure and letting yourself fail. So that's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I know that you're an athlete, which I've made reference to. I was struck by your observation that those who've been the hunters and warriors in the past are today's athletes, that somehow athleticism is a way to channel and express that same drive that hunters and warriors used to embody. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm thinking about ADHD as you are talking about today's life and how we live in a more regimented world. And it reminds me of a fantasy that I had some years ago. I still kind of think it would be a good idea. Kids, young males in particular, need to take risks. That just seems to be part of our makeup, to have adventures. And I thought that we could make use of the urban environment by having by offering activities to inner city urban youth, teaching them to climb buildings, tall buildings, doing something called bildering, you know, under supervision, probably with ropes and so on. But that would be a way to make use of this rather cold and barren structure that we have in our cities, and expose kids to real challenge and real risk without even having to go out into the other wilderness. Exactly. What do you think about that?
I think it's a really neat idea. Yeah, I was talking with David Zald, who studies the dopamine system at Vanderbilt, about the same idea. And basically, you know, he's studied the fact that people who have this high sensation seeking and easily bored, high boredom susceptibility, often become our greatest heroes, and they also become our psychopaths, or, you know. Mm-hmm. And so if they are able to channel their risk-taking tendencies into something productive, you know, like becoming firemen or, you know, going into the Coast Guard or something, that's great. But oftentimes they don't have that chance when they're young, especially if they're growing up in an urban environment where, you know, getting a gun is a cool risk to take. But, you know, yeah, climbing a building is not something that's available. And I think, you know, skateboarding parks and all these sorts of things are good push in that direction. But it needs, you know, people, a lot of adults still tend to think it seems that that's just a distraction from your studies and whatnot. But, you know, if this risk-taking sort of residue that we have and that we have to work through, and it's going to take, you know, a long time to get worked out of us, or it may never get worked out of us, and that may be a good thing. But at any rate, it needs to be honored. And I think having a, you know, sort of safe ways for youth to take risks, real risks, could be a really positive thing, especially for ADHD. I mean, the diagnoses have gone through the roof, as you know, in the last decade. And, you know, medicating more kids with amphetamines just doesn't seem like the answer. And it seems like it's necessary in some cases, but I think we need to fundamentally shift the way we're looking at education, and especially, yeah, young boys and their need to take risk.
I think you've got a story in the book about one of your buddies. I think it was about a buddy and not about yourself, who was diagnosed as ADHD and was having all kinds of problems in school and put on medication. And then he kind of found a way out through athleticism.
You're right. JT Holmes is a character in the book, and JT was diagnosed ADHD, put on Ritalin. As a kid, the Ritalin gave him headaches. He said it did work, but, you know, he didn't like the side effects. Was a skier, and a good skier, and he noticed early on that he functioned better in school when he – sorry about that. he noticed that he focused better in school when he was on the mountain, when he could have took a weekend to – ski dangerously, basically. And he followed that instinct, got off Ritalin, and started skiing every chance he got. His parents were supportive of it, fortunately, and he was able to graduate high school a year early, actually, because he put himself through summer school skiing really hard through the winter. And he became one of the best extreme skiers in history, and he still is competing on the world tour, and he is the sharpest athlete, you know, one of the sharpest athletes I've ever met. And so he was able to get his college degree while he was skiing professionally. He got off the Ritalin and Adderall, and he's just continued, you know, being a risk taker. And but he's very calculating in his risks. He trains hard. You know, he's gotten some injuries, but he's stayed safe, and he's a really happy guy. And so I think not every kid is going to be able to become a professional skier, but I think his story is telling. And there's so many athletes who were ADHD who have excelled, like Michael Phelps and Jamie Patrick, who's another character in my book.
Yeah. In fact, you described going skiing with JT on a double black diamond run, I think it was at Squaw Valley, and as courageous as you are, he wasn't cutting back and forth.
Well, right. Yeah.
He was just going straight down.
He just sort of bombed right down, and I thought, okay, I don't think I'll be skiing much with JT today.
He sounds like the kind of guy that I've seen in Warren Miller films and other films, where you see these guys kind of, it looks like they're going over cliffs, and you're just amazed that they can do that.
It is, but the key point is that so much training went into into what they're doing. And so they've been pushing their fear incrementally. And a lot of people look at them and say, God, those guys are nuts. They have no respect for their lives. Da, 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 da. But when you actually sit down and talk with these people, they really don't like the feeling of being panicked. You know, they want to be in control and they want to push just to that point where they're a little bit out of control, but still sort of on that edge. And that's where, you know, psychologists who study performance are finding that there is a sweet spot where we can get into, you know, the zone or a flow state where there's this balance of fear and also sort of dopaminergic pleasure, that shot of pleasure that we get from being in a new environment or trying a new challenge or a new type of food. And when we get that special combination of adrenaline and dopamine and everything has to come together because one false move could mean something very bad, we're capable of amazing athletic maneuvers. And I think the same is true intellectually, where if we are able to find that sweet spot in writing or you know, public speaking, that's when we can get into peak performance. And it's an elusive territory that people have tried to nail down, but it clearly has something to do with combining risk with something that you love. And so I think these sports have offer a model for that then you can experience and then try to take into other aspects of your life. And I talked to JT a lot about this, how his experiences skiing, he's been able to translate into his life off the mountain too.
Yeah, yeah. And in the book, you really do emphasize the preparation part and tell your own stories around surfing, because you've gotten to know some of the top surfers in the world. And I get the impression you may have even joined their ranks. You talk about how you prepared and trained to surf at Mavericks, which is a fairly well-known surfing area on the California coast, where unfortunately some people have died. And you kind of underscore that if you really do your homework and the right preparation, it doesn't have to have that ending.
Yeah, I mean, Mavericks is an unpredictable character. For people who don't know, it's a wave off the coast of Half Moon Bay where you can get 30 to 80 foot wave faces, and it unfortunately has taken the lives of two really successful big wave surfers. And it's funny, I do think you can minimize your risk in an environment like that, but you can never guarantee it. You're putting yourself at the mercy of something so much stronger than yourself. And as I was training to go out there, I would constantly ask myself sort of, why am I doing this? And yet I was driven to, and I think it did have a big part of to do with sort of becoming a man. And I was going through, I'd fallen in love, and I was sort of contemplating whether I could get over my commitment fears and propose to the woman I'd met. And there was a lot going on for me, and for some reason Mavericks was this rite of passage. And when you think about, you know, Lakota warriors doing their Sundance or all those rites of passage young men have been going on throughout the ages, you realize there may be something in us at a certain time of life that needs to approach death, or at least confront our fear of it. And I'm not recommending that everybody go out and do that, but for some of us, it does seem to be important. And for me, it was. And now I look back, having done that, and think, you know, I'm not sure that I need to do that anymore now that I have a son and my responsibilities are to him and my wife. But it was a really important aspect of life for me at that point, and I think it is for a lot of people.
Yeah. Shifting focus just a little bit, one of the things you talk about are that some fears are genetically programmed into us. And I think one example maybe was snakes. What are a couple of other examples?
Yeah, there do seem to be fears that we're born with, and there's a debate in the community of whether, you know, those fears are innate or whether they need to be triggered before they become actual fears. And it brings in a lot of philosophical questions about what is fear. Do you have to know what fear is for it to be a fear? And but it seems that the dark, heights, spiders, sharks, a lot of these types of fears that were loud noises, that were probably very important to avoid in the wild, are still there. And it's interesting because the things that kill us in the developed world, heart disease, car accidents, guns, are not innately feared. And so it's interesting that you know, we go around having trouble crossing bridges and getting into fMRI tubes and, you know, having nightmares about snakes when cheeseburgers and assault weapons are really what we should be born fearing these days. But it's going to take a while for that to change.
Yeah. You cite public speaking as one of the most powerful and universal fears, which I personally can attest to. Is that an innate fear or what?
It does seem that a lot of us are born with innate social anxiety. And I was talking with Rick Hansen about this. And he was basically saying that the tribe, when we were wandering around the Serengeti, was so important to our survival that if you were ostracized, that was likely a death sentence. And so the tribe's approval is still so important to us. And when else is that, you know, a more make or break situation than when you're presenting to the tribe, you know, and asking essentially for their acceptance and their praise. So it makes sense that public speaking is right up there with snakes and spiders, because we really want to belong and we really want to be accepted. And because that likely has been so important for our survival in the past. And I mean, when you talk about why our brains sort of got to the funny size that they are, it seems like cooperation was the key point there. And so anytime we're making ourselves vulnerable to the tribe and asking for their approval and praise is going to feel nerve-wracking to some of us. On the flip side, there are all these people who love it, right? Who crave to be in the top.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very similar situation where, you know, there's some people who don't want to drive over a bridge, and there's others who want to be jumping off them. And so both have been adaptive, obviously, throughout evolution, and it's just but whichever you got saddled with, it seems to be the case that you can coax your brain into changing. And people like Flea, a big wave surfer who I profile in my book, and who is probably too much on the risk-taking side and got himself into lots of trouble, drug addiction, and nearly killing himself numerous times, he's been able to reel himself in and say, you know, and I'm trusting my fear now. I've been on the, I've used up my nine lives. And whereas others have to be pushing themselves to break through their fear. And it's just about knowing yourself, I think.
You know, in the book, you tell a fascinating story about a woman who's born without an amygdala, or as you point out, amygdalae. I didn't realize there's one in each hemisphere of the brain. And so, therefore, she was fearless, which had some pluses, but also some big minuses, right?
Yeah, that was a really fascinating study. She had a rare congenital disease where she literally just had holes where her amygdala usually would be. And the most interesting part about it was, to me, was that she was a mother. She'd been able to be high functioning enough that she raised children, and they ran all these tests on her, you know, taking her to haunted houses and showing her the scariest horror movies. And she did not show physiologic stress response to any of, you know, the snakes, spiders, horror movies, roller coasters. And that had gotten her into some trouble. She seemed to have been a victim of domestic violence and had almost been, she'd been stabbed in a park, and went through to the same park that very same night or very next night. So she didn't have the normal caution, that she should have, but even so, without that, she was able to be a mom and raise a family. So it raises the question, I think, of, obviously fear is important, but most of us probably overemphasize it. The amygdala is so active in our lives and creates a lot of pain and takes years off our lives, too, when we're chronically stressed. So I thought she was a fascinating character, an example of the benefits of fear, but also the minuses.
Yes. Well, we've seen that our brains seem to have a hair trigger for a fear response. And you give many examples of this. For example, those instinctual, unreasoning fear of sharks, who actually, as you point out, have much more to fear from us than we do from them. And our fear of razor blades and in Halloween candy, to our fear of the Muslim world and terrorism, and you write about those, and you quote Rick Hansen as saying that our brains have become like Velcro for negative experiences and like Teflon for the positive ones. So it would seem that our fear on the whole might be potentially as dangerous or even more dangerous than the things that we fear. Do you know what I'm getting at?
I do. Yeah. I mean, Robert Sapolsky's done a wonderful job of showing that our fear response is killing us. And by that he means chronic fear and stress, which, create all of the, basically what the fear response does is shut down the immune system. And so when you're chronically stressed, nothing is ever rebuilt. You suffer from insomnia and erectile dysfunction, and you're more likely to get colds and heart attacks. And I mean, the list goes on. And so fear is very dangerous, especially the chronic sort. And,
there's another kind though that I took from your account of research that's been done on Halloween and the fear that we have of razor blades and the kids' candy. And you point out that that's basically an urban myth that's, you know, happened. So there's an emotional contagion aspect about fear that we haven't really spoken about. And it makes me think of all these people now who are rushing out to buy guns in the wake of the recent shooting of 26 people in Connecticut on the one hand and the fiscal cliff on the other. Can you comment on these?
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. And yeah, I agree with you. There are certain situations where our automatic fear response gets us into a lot of trouble. And the example I use in the book is this Halloween candy scare, which, you know, ever since I can remember, we've been told every year that you might get a razor blade or strychnine or cyanide in your Halloween candy, and it's on the news. Joel Best, this professor who's looked into it, has found that there has actually never been a single death from Halloween candy sadism in the United States. There's been a few cases where, like, a dad poisoned his kid for insurance money, and there's been a couple of pranks, or a time when a kid died of a heart attack or something and had happened to eat some Halloween candy. But these basically tap into our worst fears, right? Somebody's out to get our kids, and they spread like wildfire. And fear, because it was such an important survival mechanism, does spread between us, and we can actually recognize a scared face and get a fear response from that scared face before our conscious mind even knows what that face is. So it flashes so fast on a screen that it doesn't even register consciously, but the fear responses are already tracked it, logged it, started releasing adrenaline and cortisol. And that's happening constantly with all of these little triggers around us. We're being duped by fear and reacting in the wrong direction. So the guns case is a perfect example. I mean, here we had a horrible mishap in Newton, and the proper fear response, in my opinion, is to fear these assault weapons. If there weren't access to these weapons, you know, these things wouldn't happen. But what a lot of us jump to, the equivalent of the blue square in my Daniela Schiller experiment, and said, oh, we're going to fear sending our kids to school, and, you know, until we get armed guards and we buy our own guns or what have you. And so that's an example of the associative mechanism of this ancient fear response casting a blanket fear over everything. And instead of being precise and saying, well, the thing to fear here is the assault weapons and the fact that we don't have proper treatment for the mentally ill, you know, we're going to fear schools and we're going to set up that fear association for our children. And if kids don't feel safe in school, they're not going to learn as well, right? The neuro research is very clear on that, that if a kid is stressed at school, the prefrontal cortex doesn't develop as well. And so I think this, the knee-jerk reaction to, you know, to securitize schools, though understandable, is actually puts children in greater danger of not having feeling safe at school, and making the wrong association. The sharks example is a more clear one, because it's so obvious that sharks actually kill fewer than one person in the United States per year dies of a shark attack, and for years, we felt great killing sharks because we thought the fewer the sharks, the fewer number of humans who will die. Well, meanwhile, we didn't realize that sharks are an apex predator who are extremely important to our environment, our ecosystems. And without sharks, you know, the fish fisheries we rely on go haywire. And so now finally we've started passing laws against shark finning and killing sharks. But somewhere between 30 and 100 million sharks are killed every year just for their fins. And so they're in great danger. And in China, where a lot of the fins go, they're still using that excuse that sharks are dangerous and sort of the more you kill, the better. And that can feel right to the ancient fear system, but it's just, it's a knee-jerk reaction that isn't actually helpful.
Yeah. So, still on the topic of emotional contagion of fear, I have really mixed feelings about reading the newspaper in the morning. It's kind of a habit that I have, and I feel like, well, I'm supposed to be an educated citizen. But on the other hand, it seems like it's a real blue square moment because there are all this upsetting, fear-invoking stuff. And even if I can kind of take a consciously hardened, maybe numbed attitude, at some level, you know, I'm getting all these little blue squares popping up, mm-hmm. bracing myself.
I know, yeah, I feel the same way. I think there's a balance that has to be struck there. I mean, as a journalist, I'm immersed in the news a lot of the time. And I don't think we realize how much we're triggered by it. And now triggered by getting the same news in our Twitter feeds and Facebook and texts and such constantly. And the I'm thinking of writing an article called The Paleo Diet for the Mind, where if we don't basically respect the fact that our primal brain was not prepared to be inundated with this many threats per day, we are liable to become mentally ill. I mean, there's no other way to put it, because look, I mean, for the last 200 million years, we've had an incredible amount of downtime, right? In between hunting and gathering, there were times where you were just walking and, you know, looking at the sun or sunset or, you know, resting and recuperating. And now we're taking in so many threats per minute or per hour that we don't really know how to sort through it. And you won't notice it until you go on a vacation or a retreat. I just did a 3-day retreat where I didn't allow myself to read or write or read the news. And I just kind of stayed outside and meditated and did stuff like that. And the first bit of news you pick up, you're extremely sensitive to after a time like that. And you realize mm-hmm. that, usually you just sort of, steamroll over that feeling and you go to the next one and you steamroll over that and it collects. And if you don't have time to empty out, then, you start feeling really weird and you have trouble sleeping. And, I don't think it's just the news. It's the number of threats that we, you know, the threat can be, your boss texting you on the weekend or what have you. But I think there needs to be at least one day a week, from my experience, where it's sort of like a non-blue square day, so to speak, where you're only going to deal with the threats that actually pop up in your physical consciousness, you know, like your kids running towards the waves and you need to stop them or something because you went to the beach with the family. But having a day where you're not taking in everyone else's threats basically halfway across the world, because as much as we need to be aware of people's problems around the world and try to help, we can't do it all, you know, and we certainly can't do anything if we're feeling sick from stress.
Well, that's a great point, and this might be a good place for us to wind down, although I'm sure we could go on and on and on. I wonder if there are any final points that you'd like to make, maybe something you kind of, a point that you had hoped to make that maybe I didn't ask the right question to evoke it.
Well, I think that last point is the one that I'm feeling the most. I go in to a lot of different points when it comes to fear and different ways that we can manage fear and embrace fear and turn fear around and use it to our advantage for performance and et cetera. But as we're going into the new year and we're sort of finishing up a rather stressful year, 2012, you know, we had the Newton shooting and the flooding and the Colorado shooting, and it was a lot for the psyche to take in. And I think the whole country could use sort of an unplugging and a recalibrating, mm-hmm. because it's not as bad as you think. I mean, we had actually an amazing amount of good news in 2012. There was the violent crime fell for the fifth straight year. Cancer deaths were down yet again for the 12th straight year or something like that. teenage drunk driving was halved in the last decade. There were a lot of good news points out there, but we will feel as if the world is more violent than ever before, because, like Rick Hansen said, the brain is like Velcro for the negative experience and Teflon for the positive one. So we won't look back at 2012 and say, oh, you know, what a great year. We'll tend to say, wow, thank goodness that's over. Let's bring in 2013. But there were a lot of positives in 2012, and there's going to be a lot in 2013. So I think, you know, giving ourselves a break at the start of the new year and reminding ourselves to focus on the positive is a great way to get our fear response sort of functioning as it should, which is, you know, able to react to the real threats and, you know, shred the paper tigers essentially. And so give yourself, you know, a treat in 2013 and take a break.
I think that's a great recommendation. And by the way, I subscribe to something, I can't remember the exact name, but it's something like the Good News newsletter that I get through email. And it's a great antidote. And sometimes I'm so caught up in other stuff that I don't read it, which is a telling, a very telling thing, you know, about how we're wired. I'll generalize it beyond myself to say it's how we are wired to kind of place higher priority all the things that we busy ourselves with and tend to be sort of nervous and concerned about. But I'm probably opening up a whole nother oyster here. So let me say, Jamal, that I hope that 2013 is very good to you. I think this book ought to be on the bestseller list, and that's what I'm rooting for as we go ahead. So it's been great to speak with you, and I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, it's been so much fun, Dave. Thanks. Keep up the great work.
I'm sure you could tell that I feel very drawn to Jamal. I guess in part because he's lived out some of my own unrealized dreams. My appreciation and understanding of the importance of my own athleticism came late. I've always been at an intermediate level of all the sports activities I've taken up. I don't think I was born with any dramatic gifts in that department, but I'm like the little engine that says, I think I can, I think I can, I think I can. At about 125 pounds in high school, I showed true grit playing tackle football and in track as well. Later in my 30s and 40s, I became a solid intermediate skier and tennis player. And somewhere in my later 40s, I became an intermediate mountain biker and later a road biker. I tried to take up surfing a couple of times, but I discovered I really needed to have started much earlier in life. In judo, I got as far as a second-degree brown belt, again, a kind of an intermediate level. I'm glad to have been given a sturdy enough body to participate at the levels I did, and as I look back, I really relish all the good times I had in those activities, especially when they were shared with a friend or two. I've often said that if I ever get reincarnated, I'll be a surfer and also a better skier and a musician, a pianist in particular. So Jamal represents my ego ideal, both in his physical accomplishments and his courage and spirit. And he also represents an ego ideal in terms of his writing. I do believe that his book belongs on the bestseller list. If it doesn't make it, I think it's because there's been such a rash of books on neuroscience and flow and so on of late. I think he's done a masterful job of sharing his personal stories and integrating them with relevant findings from neuroscience and psychology. His book is a very compelling read. As if I didn't already have enough to read, what with putting out a new podcast every week, almost always focusing on a book, and me being increasingly visually challenged due to the aging process, but I'm really feeling like I'm going to want to read his earlier book, Saltwater Buddha. He tells me a documentary will be coming out about that one, and I think I'm going to want him back on the show, and we'll focus on the documentary and that earlier book. He's one of those somewhat rare souls who is both very physical but also very introspective and sensitive. I can own that I have those qualities myself to some degree, and he makes a great projection screen for my own not fully realized self. I'd like to close this section with reading a paragraph near the end of the book to give you a feel for Jamal's writing. On page 195, he writes, and I quote, "I have no idea how I will feel when death comes, and I have no idea if freedom from the fear of death is completely possible, even for the monk or nun who sits in meditation as the last bit of life leaves the body, or the soldier who wants to die with honor, or the mother who throws herself into harm's way to protect her child. But if I've learned anything in this research on fear, I guess it's not really specifically about death or even about fear. If I've learned anything, it's that nature has selected a whole variety of traits for us, some good, some bad, and some a combination of the two. But the brain and the mind and the body have more plasticity than we ever imagined. We are constantly evolving. We learn from events, from one another, from our own emphases and awarenesses. A single thought changes the very structure of our brains. Think about that for a moment. A single thought moves matter. And that's a good thing if we use that malleability wisely. We can take this biological mess of wild impulses, hormones, ferocious emotions, and sharp intellect that we're saddled with and do something worthwhile, maybe something beautiful."
I've been laying on this couch, babe. I've been laying here so long, just waiting for Dr. Dave, babe, to play his shrink wrap radio song. Oh, he plays it so sweet and he plays it so warm. Shrink wrap radio, it's a harbor from the storm. You know he speaks to your mind, babe, but he's really speaking to your soul. Talking shrink wrap radio, babe. You know that's just the way that he rolls. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, babe, it's all in your mind. At the end of the day, you know what you'll find. Like Dr. Dave said, it's all in your mind.
By the way, Bob asked me to remind you to help support Shrink Wrap Radio by clicking on the big green donate button on our site. Not that, Bob, silly. But still, it's a good idea. In fact, I highly recommend it. We have a new transcript on the site thanks to Gloria Allman. It's number 331, A Jungian Approach to Addiction with David Shane, a Jungian analyst. It's a really good one, and so having a transcript will be really helpful to many of you, I think, for reviewing it or referring to it for a report for school or whatever. And if you're interested in being a transcriptionist yourself, if you go to our transcripts page and scroll down, you will see in red some that need doing. And so just email me and let me know that you're interested in transcribing that episode. Let me call your attention to past interviewees who have paid a nominal fee to advertise their book on our site. If you go to the right-hand sidebar, you'll see small ads for Unlocking the Emotional Brain by Bruce Ecker, Eight Keys to Brain-Body Balance by Robert Scare, The Psychology of Music Performance Anxiety by Diana Kenny. Also her other book, Bringing Up Baby by Diana Kenny. The Individuation of God by Peter B. Todd. Biofeedback for the Brain by Paul Swingle. Marked by Fire by Jungian analysts Patricia Damery and Ruth Naomi Lewinsky. Cyberbullying No More by Holly Kinley. The Pregnant Darkness by Jungian analyst Monica Wickman. These are each wonderful books, and the authors have shown faith in Shrink Wrap Radio and the Shrink Wrap Radio audience by advertising here. So I hope you'll reward them and yourself by purchasing one or more of their books. Clicking on the book cover on our page will take you right to their Amazon.com purchase page. It couldn't be easier. And if you're an author and would like to advertise your book similarly, please contact me via email. In the next few days, I'm going to be putting out my latest newsletter in conjunction with the Jung platform. If you're not on our mailing list, you can add yourself to it, as many people have been doing. You'll see an entry form in the top left of the homepage, and in return, you'll get a free dream lecture that I gave some years back. Did you know that we also offer an iPhone/Android shrink wrap radio app? It's a great way to listen to these shows on the go, and you'll find full details in the apps tab on our site. Finally, please help to spread the word about Shrink Wrap Radio. I just know there are lots of folks out there who would love this content if only they knew about it. As you know, it's also a great resource for teachers, students, grad students, and all sorts of therapists and personal coaches.
Hi, this is Jungian analyst and author, Dr. Tamar Kron, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Tamar Kron, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Now, let's hear from our listener community. Here's a short audio clip from Gloria Allman in Australia, whom I mentioned earlier for her transcript of Dr. David Shane. Let's listen.
Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Gloria Allman from Adelaide, South Australia. I've been listening to the podcasts for quite some time now, and I think I've pretty well listened to all of them going right back to the beginning. They're a great part of my continuing life education. My main areas of interest are dreams, all things Jungian, and neuroscience, all of which you give great coverage to. I became interested in Jung and joined our local Jung Society 16 years ago when I began having precognitive dreams and wanted to understand what was going on. For several years, I would just sit in on the meetings, really not having much of a clue at all what the people were talking about. But gradually, I think probably by a process of osmosis, it began filtering through. And now I'm dedicated to understanding the psychology that Jung proposes. And in that regard, Shrink Wrap Radio is my partner. Thank you, Dr. Dave.
And thank you, Gloria. It's wonderful having you as a partner to Shrink Wrap Radio. And I especially appreciate not only the good use you've made of these interviews, but also your help as a transcriptionist. Next, we hear from Giannis, and I hope I've got that pronunciation somewhat right, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Giannis, and I am writing to you from London, UK, although in Cairo, Egypt at the moment. I am a Jungian analyst in training, and I discovered your show today through the Jung platform. I listened to a couple of podcasts with more to come, and I wanted to thank you for this excellent effort of yours. Keep it up. My best wishes," and that's from Giannis or something close to that. And that's great to hear that you discovered me through the Jung platform. I've only recently become allied with them. And so, of course, I hope it's mutually beneficial for the Jung platform and for Shrink Wrap Radio, and it sounds like it is. So that's wonderful to hear. I wish you all the best in your continuing Jungian studies, and stay with us. I've interviewed lots of Jungian analysts, as you will discover, and there will be more coming along in the future. Next, we hear from Sally, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. Just to let you know, I really enjoy your podcasts, as I'm interested in positive psychology and Jung, plus many of your chosen topics, many others of your chosen topics. I wonder if you know of any good, recognized positive psychology qualifications available online. I'm writing from the UK, and at the moment there are no courses going that I can attend, as positive psychology seems to be much more the thing in the Americas. I wonder if there is a way I can study this by distance learning. I am not a psychologist, just an interested bystander, but I would like to have a recognized course that I can use on my resume. Any thoughts would be much appreciated. Kind regards, Sally." And I wrote back to Sally and suggested, hey, why don't you take our full sequence that we have for continuing education? I think it's 32 units worth through the Zur Institute. And when you create that full sequence, you get a certificate. And that's something that you could list on your resume. And of course, it just involves mostly listening to the podcasts, the very ones that you're interested in that touch on positive psychology. And by the way, I should mention that those units are recognized by the American Psychological Association. Other than that, I don't have a good source for you. And here's one last one from longtime listener and supporter, Andy Hunt. Andy writes, "Hi, David. Just listened to your excellent interview with Dr. David Feinstein. It was refreshing to have a sober, informal conversation about energy psychology. Oftentimes, talks about EFT and other unconventional processes degenerate into an argument between the devotees, it always works on everything, versus the detractors, it never works on anything. So it was a delight to hear your intelligent and balanced conversation about the possibilities and difficulties of these techniques. I was particularly interested in the thorny issue of inadequately trained practitioners biting off far more than they can chew. In the aftermath of disasters such as the dreadful school shooting, I think there's a danger of well-meaning fools rushing in where angels fear to tread. I was pleased to hear Dr. Feinstein's well-considered response to those concerns. As an EFT practitioner and trainer, I think EFT and similar processes have a lot to offer. But I would say that, wouldn't I? However, getting conventionally trained professionals to entertain using it is no small task. I suspect the journey from lunatic fringe to mainstream may take a little while yet, but it's a very interesting journey. Thanks once again for all your hard work. It's much appreciated. All the best, Andy." And then he adds, "P.S., I'm with you on the likelihood of a neurological explanation of therapeutic mechanisms of these techniques." Well, Andy, it's great to hear from you as always. And I either didn't know or had forgotten that you were an EFT practitioner. And so that's good to know. You're one of my trusted listeners, so if you're into it, that's another good endorsement. By the way, I just got an almost just-in-time email from the man training to be a Jungian analyst, whose name I pronounced Giannis. He just sent me a phonetic guide, and I believe the correct pronunciation would be Aoanis. I hope I got it right this time. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype where I'm ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Jamal Yogis, for sharing his many explorations, both personally and neuroscientifically, on fear. My next guest will be friend and Israeli Jungian analyst, Dr. Tamar Krohn, and we'll be discussing her book on the couple archetype. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. all the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.